And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I am Martin Willis, your host, and we are coming at you live on YouTube, and welcome, everyone. I do want to say that I had a wonderful pre-recorded news with Alejandro Rojas. We actually had a really good news segment. There was some laughing. There was some crying. He's off to Mexico. I do want to tell you that check out his website, openminds.tv, and you'll see a great article about George Bush being interviewed by Jimmy Kimmel. And you know what's going on with that. There's a really strange UFO sighting, too. It has to do with a beach ball-sized light or orb that kind of was in the front of a windshield of a car. I think it was California. Really great sighting, so check it out. And that is all right on the openminds.tv. I also want to say something I did in the pre-recorded news. And it was kind of funny, by the way, as I was getting to load it into the show. You could hear me talking, but it was absolutely no talking on his end. And I have a new computer. That's good news as far as you people who have put up with static for so long. I found out through a lot of work after I changed a lot of my equipment that it was my computer. It was a 2008. I should have known better. So I have a brand new shiny computer here. And if there's any static, I will probably douse gasoline on the whole everything and just set it on fire and use my headphones next week. But anyway, so I do want to thank everyone that supports the show. And if you'd like to help out for $2 or less a month, that's less than a cup of coffee. All you have to do is go to podcastufo.com and go to the support page. Also, Monday night, we had our second Monday night show, and we have another one coming up this Monday. And it's Bigfoot. We're going to be talking Bigfoot and cryptoids with Stan Gordon. Now, just keep in mind, that's YouTube only. So the only way you can watch that is to go to the everything-else-show.com. And there's a variety of topics. We're booked all the way into May. All kinds of great stuff coming up on that show. And it's YouTube only, Monday nights. And you can watch it afterwards. There's an archives page. You can watch or listen to it. I'm not making it into a podcast. I'm a little bit lazy. I got a lot to do, and I think that would just add a little bit too much. So I'm not going to be doing that in the near future as it sits. So we are ready to bring in our guest. And Preston Dennett, how are you? Welcome to the show.
Doing good. How are you?
Thanks so much for coming on. And you sent me a book, and I want to thank you for sending me that book. And you signed it and put a nice letter in it. It was really nice. And I tell you what, I got a chance to breeze through it, and I'm sorry I didn't get to read it. But you are you have a lot of books. How many books do you have so far?
That would be my 20th book. Wow. My 14th. Yeah, that's my 14th one about UFOs,
though. Oh, is that right? Wow. So, I didn't realize that you wrote other books. What other topics do you write on?
I started having cover other paranormal subjects because I found out they were kind of related. You know, ghosts, out-of-body experiences, yeah. Bigfoot, human levitation. I wrote on that because people were floating around up into UFOs. Uh-huh. So to some extent, they're all related.
Yes.
So, yeah, I've covered.
As a matter of fact, I had Paul Eno. I don't know if you know who Paul is. Paul was on my show a while back and just kind of basically said that everything is related. And it has to do with the multiverse type of thing. It was kind of fascinating. So I don't know, you know, of course, there's absolutely nothing to back up any claims anyone makes, as you know. And the title of your book, I wanted to ask you about that. Speaking of claims, Inside UFOs and True Accounts of Contact. And is that with a little caveat, the true accounts part?
Oh, no. No, I'm absolutely 100% convinced these people are telling the truth. I've interviewed each of them multiple times. Many of them have character witnesses to back them up.
Mm-hmm.
Some have physical evidence. But yeah, I've been doing this for so long. I became convinced UFOs were real long ago. This is not science fiction. This is absolutely true. And yeah.
And now, do these people that you're talking about, that you are absolutely convinced, are they people that you have found along the way, or are these people that have read your books and gotten in contact with you? How does that all happen?
Some have definitely contacted me because they know of my research or read my books, and they email me, find my website. Others come up to me after a UFO convention, like the guy in Chapter 1. That's how he found me. I was speaking in San Diego, and he came up to me afterwards. One of the ladies in the book, actually, I worked with her for years. It's very interesting. You know, she came up to my desk one day, and I just put up a statue that someone gave me of a little gray E.T. Uh-huh. And yeah, she screams out loud, like, "What's that?" And I'm like, well, what do you think it is? And she's like, well, you know, I don't know, but I saw one of those.
Oh.
And that's how I got her story. Okay. Yeah.
Hey, you know, before we get too much longer here, I just wanted to give a little shout out because I did earlier in the news that actually didn't record. But I want to give a shout out to a man called Phil. Now, Phil has helped the show almost from the beginning for a couple of 2 or 3 years. Been a great supporter. We talk almost after every show, just about, and a great guy. And he just retired today. He retired very young. He's a scientist. He takes a serious look at this topic, among other topics. So, Phil, I just want to congratulate you and thank you for everything you've done for the show. And happy retirement, Phil. So, thumbs up. All right. So, thank you. I just didn't want to forget that, Preston. Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah. So let's, now I should say to the new listener, Preston has been on this show previously. And do you want to just for the new listener, because we do have quite a few, because now we're on YouTube, can you tell the listener about your own personal experiences?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up very skeptical of this subject, skeptical of pretty much all things paranormal, until one day in 1986, November, I heard a report on the news about a sighting over Alaska. It's a very well-known sighting. The newscasters treated it very tongue-in-cheek, joked about it, laughed nervously, and moved on.
Are you talking about the JAL 165 or whatever it was? Yeah.
Right. Kenju Taroshi, the pilot. Yeah. They tracked it for, 60 miles for over an hour. It was on their radar. It's a great case.
It's one of the best, I think. Sure. Mm-hmm.
Right. None of that was in the news, by the way. They just kind of joked about it. But it interested me enough. I kept thinking, well, this pilot is kind of putting his reputation on the line.
Yeah.
By the way, he ended up getting fired from a flight duty.
Right.
As a result of going public.
But the good thing about that is they did give him his job back, and that was a thanks to Richard Haynes. I found that out recently. A thanks to Richard Haynes from NARCAP. But also that, you know, of course, he had to have a desk job, which, you know, such a seasoned pilot with such great experience. It's a real shame when something like that happens.
Can you imagine? Yeah, I knew none of that. I just thought, my God, this pilot is lying. Or he's on drugs. He's pulling off a hoax. This is outrageous.
Yeah. Wow. That's something else. So that's what kind of got you started in this whole thing?
Well, that was the trigger. I found out then. I started asking people. My brother had seen a UFO. My sister-in-law saw gray-type ETs and had a sighting with three other people. people at work had had sightings. One had missing time. Another ended up having a full-on encounter with gray ETs. Yes. Another friend had missing time.
Do you work with a lot of people?
At my office, I got like a bunch of cases there. There's a high turnover. It's not a huge office, 20 or 30 people.
Wow, it's amazing. You know, it's funny. I've talked about this a few times that, you know, you get in conversation with the average person out there, and if you dare to touch a subject or, like, they spotted the little alien toy, you know, something like that, once you get into a subject, you find out that a lot of people either know someone or they had something happen. And, it's really it's not such a taboo topic. I think it's becoming more and more easy to talk about.
Yeah, finally. Yeah. I mean, back in the day, it wasn't.
Right, right.
You know, people, I could clear a room pretty fast and still can. Yeah. But, and, you know, people are talking about it more, but not if you're being abducted, not necessarily. I mean, yeah, more people are coming forward, but people still don't talk about it casually. Right. Say, oh, you know, the other day, guess where I was? I was inside a flying saucer. But no, they don't normally. I mean, it's getting better. It's gotten so much better.
You know, I've said a number of times that if indeed I thought I was being abducted and I actually had some of these experiences that you hear about, I would be absolutely horrified. I don't think I could function. You know, I mean, I think it would be on my mind, and that's all that would be on my mind. You know, according to some of the accounts that you hear that people talk about, it's hard to fathom how they can just, you know, maintain some type of normalcy in their life.
That's exactly why I got involved, because, I mean, it hit me hard, and I wasn't having experiences. Mm-hmm. But it was really difficult to adjust my whole worldview. And back, you know, when this wasn't as mainstream as it is now, I can't imagine how hard it was for people who've had this experience. Now there's all kinds of resources.
Right, right.
But even then, people often tell me, you know, they call the police or they call the UFO reporting center and they'll call various people, and it takes them a while to find, you know, someone who's actually interested in their encounter and takes it seriously.
Yeah. I find that, you know, I know you live in Southern California, and I lived out in Northern California in the Marin County for 9 years. And I think that the West Coast, the California coast, seems to accept things first, and then it kind of floats, you know, somewhat across the country over to the East Coast, and, you know, things become a little bit more acceptable. But I think that... you know, the subjects, the paranormal subjects, are a little more acceptable on the West Coast. I know you have nothing to compare by, but I can kind of see that. You know, there's a lot of conservatism, but when it comes to California, they can, you know, they seem to open arm to a lot of different ideas and things.
Yeah, I think California's always been kind of a leader in the whole New Age movement, you could say.
Yeah.
With the, you know, channeling and psychics and all kinds of things. We have more Bigfoot encounters than any other state.
You have the famous Patterson film up there in, you know, Northern California.
Right.
That no one's been able to tear apart so far. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. We have more UFO sightings than anyone else in the United States.
Is that right? You know, I understand that. First of all, the weather is absolutely fabulous for the most part out there. Open skies and a lot of... geographical area, but and also the population. So people are outside a lot more, you know, year round than they are anywhere else. And I totally understand why there's, you know, that's where I had my incredible sighting was out in, you know, in Carmel Valley, Monterey area.
Yeah, there's a lot of people out here. I have noticed that, you know, people who are in the summer months, sightings go up, definitely.
Yeah.
Particularly because, you know, the nights are real warm, and that's when UFOs are particularly visible.
Now, do you ever get involved yourself in any type of sky watching? People always ask me that question and just wonder about you. Do you ever get involved in any of that?
I do, much more so, you know, when I was initially getting involved with the UFO research. I was... constantly going out to wherever there were sightings. I was driving around to staying out late at night. I joined CSETI when it formed here in LA. I was a charter member. And, you know, we went out with 40 people on the first night, saw a UFO.
Honest to God. Well, you know, I know someone else in then went to New York. There was a meeting there, and I was kind of giving her a hard time about it. And then, you know, she said, I'll be darned if we didn't see something, all of us. You know, and, you know, I don't know. I think I went to out in Phoenix out there. We did a night watch with night vision. Ben Hansen had all this wonderful equipment. And you kind of get caught up in the moment. You know, we saw a bat, and, you know, bats fly around crazy. And at first I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, I'm seeing a UFO. So I think, you know, that can happen. There can be a little bit, you know, people getting a little excited, you know, to see something. But, now, just one of the questions about your book. What inspired you? Was it just all the cases that you knew about and you decided to? Because I know you do, like, UFOs over Arizona, over New York. Someone said they read your book. They really enjoyed it a lot. So you kind of, this is a little curve in the road. What made you put this book together?
Well, actually, it was a long time coming. I did have I was pretty much involved in these UFOs over series. I had a double book contract with Schiffer Books. I had to put that out. But I am super excited about this book because, yeah, these are my own cases. You know, in those UFOs over series, I draw from a very wide variety of sources, newspapers, articles, magazines, you name it, books, other researchers. But this particular book contains 10 all new original cases. These have never before been published. They're people that I interviewed and kind of the more extensive cases. Kind of my requirement was that these people had to have either had missing time, face-to-face contact, or an onboard experience. Most of them are on board.
Wow. Now, what type of interviews did you do? Did you do face-to-face on some of these, or were they, you did?
Yeah, well, whenever I could. I would say a good 30%. I mean, the lady I worked with, the other guy I met at a convention, and we ended up meeting face-to-face. One guy, he's become a very good friend, so we visit regularly. And another lady I worked with. So, yeah, about half. Some are phone interviews. Now I love Skype because, you know, that really allows you to get up, you know, go face-to-face with a person without having to travel there.
Right. Back to the UFOs over New York. We had a question in the chat room and by the gentleman that read your book, UFOs over New York. And he wanted me to ask you what your point of view is on New York State as far as, you know, sightings go. I know I've spoken to a few people there, and there's quite a bit happening, yes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's got one of the top five hot spots in the United States, for sure. You know, there's Sedona. There's the whole Topanga Canyon, Malibu area. There is Gulf Breeze, perhaps. But Hudson Valley, upstate New York, Pine Bush, has been active for a very long time, and it's my understanding that it continues to be pretty active. Yeah,
I know. I've talked to people that have actually gone out in their lawn chairs in Pine Bush, you know, beside their car, and people are seeing things all the time there. Pretty amazing. And
yeah, I mean, if you want to see a UFO, it's just a matter of going out and looking for them. It's not that hard to do. I never saw a UFO growing up. Saw anything until I got involved in this, started going out looking for them. And I've had over, you know, the last 30 years, 15 really high quality sightings.
Wow. That's amazing. You know, I think a lot of it has to do with looking because, you know, everybody's looking down at their smartphone these days. You know, a lot of people are really involved in their lives, no matter what it is. And, you know, getting to work, stress, you know, money stress and family. And, you know, a lot of people don't look up. You know, the only time you kind of get a view of the sky is on your commute. And, you know, you're talking about the parkway. I mean, the Hudson Valley. What was the, I'm sorry, I just lost the name of that site, all those sightings there.
upstate New York.
Yeah, the Hudson, whatever.
Upstate, yeah, Hudson Valley. The Taconic Parkway, I think it's called.
Now, I've heard some controversy over the years, and mostly from, you know, skeptics that, you know, it was this or that, but they never really figured that out, right?
Yeah, they tried to say it was ultralight planes, which is patently ridiculous. I mean, it's demonstrably false. You can bring together any group of witnesses, and it just does not match anything like ultralight planes. These were very large craft. They came very low down over the highway on many, many occasions, stopping traffic. They were completely silent. A number of these people reported telepathic contact or abductions.
Wow, I didn't hear that part. Now, I had a skeptic on the show a year and a half or 2 years ago named Evan Bernstein from the Skeptics. It's a famous show that he's on, a very popular show with the Skeptic Society. And he said he had a sighting on the parkway, and he just, like, dismissed it. I think that's kind of curious, you know. I mean, he didn't say that, you know, it was explained or anything other than that he just dismissed the whole thing. And do you think that, do you think that's almost a fear-based, you know, situation where someone would just say, it's nothing?
Partly. I think there's a couple of explanations, actually. I think that can be induced by the ETs. Someone will be driving along and see something, and they'll say, oh, you know, that's nothing. Don't look at it. It's just a plane. They can disguise themselves as planes. They can cloak themselves. They can, if they don't want to be seen, they're not going to be seen. Yeah. But on the other hand, you know, some people are so profoundly skeptical, they're just not ready. I interviewed, this was initially one of the ladies I worked with for years. Her name was Dorothy. And she was with her friend Carol. They were at the Pio Pico Library in Koreatown when this UFO comes diving down out of the sky and hovers like right over the telephone wires across the street. They know it's 9 o'clock. The library has just closed. Their mom comes to pick them up, and they start to drive home, and this UFO follows them.
Wow.
I interviewed all three of them. They described it as looking like, you know, a classic flying saucer with little lights around it, just your classic flying saucer. And I interviewed the mother, and she's like, yeah, it looked like two bowls put together, had little lights around it. I don't believe in UFOs. And she ended or started every single sentence with that. You know, I don't believe in UFOs, but yeah, it was silent and it was following us. And, you know, I don't believe in UFOs, but yeah, it followed us all the way home. And it was 10:15 when we got home. It was very strange because they live 5 minutes from the library.
I got to tell you, I've told this story on the show before, but like I said before, there's a lot of new listeners. I was doing a show in my previous residence, which was actually a condo on a golf course. And I was doing my show, and I was down, and I had a studio down in like the finished basement doing. And there was a knock at the door that I just plain ignored. And so afterwards, I you know, checked with a neighbor, and I said, did someone knock on your door? She said, I did. And I said, oh, what's going on? And she said, a big, huge triangle thing was like, I thought it was going to land in the golf course. She said, I was out there, and she said, I wanted you to come out. This was during my show. So I said, really? I said, what type of noise did it make? She goes, come to think of it, there wasn't any. I didn't hear any noise. I don't know. And so I said, wow, would you like to? I got to tell you, I do a show on UFO. She goes, no. I don't believe in UFOs. So, you know, and I said, are you sure? I said, you can be anonymous, you know, just be on my show and just talk about it. She said, nope, I'm not interested. So, I couldn't get her on, but that was pretty exciting. No other, people that I know of, you know, saw that one, but yeah, that's in Maine too. So
kind of a bizarre coincidence. That's some, I personally think that these guys, the ETs, are aware very much of what's going on. When you're doing a radio show, and when you're investigating UFOs, they're aware of it.
You know, I wouldn't doubt it because there's just so many strange things, you know, that I've heard just in people's accounts. I could go into different cases, but these are, you know, past people on the show that have actually, you know, talked about this. And, you know, there's just some strange things that you just can't explain. How on earth could someone be driving along a highway and then a UFO far away that they had some type of contact with before come over to them? You know what I mean? There's so many different things that are just so bizarre. We have some questions that came into the forum. And do the accounts of contact from your book come from the use of hypnotic? Do any of the accounts come from any hypnotic regression? Did you ever get involved in any part of that or any of the people that you've interviewed?
Partially. There are only two accounts in the book that actually use regressive hypnosis. I absolutely support hypnosis as a tool for recovering, you know, missing time. I think it's been proven accurate. It's been used not only by in this field, but in, you know, the police field and other areas, of course. But I don't generally, you know, I recommend people to jump to it. There are other ways to recall this stuff, and through, you know, meditation, dreams, an in-depth interview can bring out new details. But yeah, two people ended up going under hypnosis because they had some profound missing time.
Right.
And that kind of, in that case, I would recommend it. I would definitely do it personally because I would want to know. But you're opening up a can of worms at the same time. I mean, you might find out you've been abducted since your childhood. Are you ready for that?
Yeah, I've talked to Travis Walton about that. He said, you know, one time was enough. He'll never do it again. He's scared. And he thinks he's only had one encounter. It's just that he really doesn't want to know more any more than he already does. You know, I hate to jump back to something, but we have a question. A few people are asking about it on the message board. Do you have a theory on the Hudson Valley as a hotspot? And we can talk a little bit about hotspots. But do you have any type of theory on that?
Yeah, I do. You know, I did a study of hotspots, and I noticed it had a lot of commonalities with other hotspots. It was a pretty rural area next to a very large population base. So one theory is that they're kind of using it as a place to hide out while they still have access, you know, to a lot of people, which is kind of their goal. Another thing I noticed, particularly with that area, is it's very rich in minerals. It's got a lot of mines. And there's a number of reports of these objects coming in and out of the ground. And so I think there's a possibility that we're looking at some sort of mining operation or underground base. Certainly that was the theory brought up by Philip Imbrogno.
Oh.
Imbrogno.
I know. That's not exactly it, but yeah. Rogier, I think I know who you're talking about.
The guy who wrote the Hudson Valley UFO Wave.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Philip Imbrogno.
Okay, yeah.
And the other lady who wrote about Pine Bush, Ellen Crystal, she wrote a book about Pine Bush, Silent Invasion. Mm-hmm. And she said the same thing. So, I mean, it's just a theory, but I think it does explain why there's such high levels of activity
there.
Well,
I'll tell you, that is kind of a common thing you do hear about hotspots, not all hotspots, but some of the hotspots, is that there's minerals. You know, there's copper in Brown Mountain. I'm trying to remember over in Denmark where there's a hotspot, there's something like, you know, something going on. And whether it's elements that attract or, like you said, mining, that's, you know, taking another step. But, I mean, it seems, you know, a lot of people will say that it's a natural, you know, unusual phenomena because of the minerals. But I don't know. I mean, like I said before, we're all guessing anyway, really. But let's talk about your book. And also there was a question in the forum as well, the kind of... along the lines, what makes you think there's actually evidence for people actually having these encounters?
Oh, well, I mean, every person I've talked to has some form of evidence. A lot of it is circumstantial, I'll give you that. eyewitness testimony is definitely a form of evidence, right? But a lot of these people have more than that. A number of them have medical evidence. There's one guy in the book who had repeated incidents with missing time and would afterwards have triangular marks, burns, bruises, and other stuff like that. He was taken once and his bedroom door was left open. And the dog was completely traumatized. The dog was never the same again. There's one lady, she had an experience with a 9-foot-tall praying mantis type, you know, gray grasshopper-like, bug-like being. And she heard that some people who are abducted, their skin will actually fluoresce under a black light. This is kind of a rare symptom, I guess. And so she checked it out with her friend. And no one had it except she did, definitely. So that's a form of evidence. There's another lady who was healed of an illness as a result of her encounter. Another gentleman had an illness as a result of his encounter. And another guy, he saw his UFO with about a dozen other Navy men, and they were sharing two pairs of binoculars. So, I mean, how much evidence do you need?
Yeah. No? Well, you know, the skeptic look at this, you know, people will pick apart, you know, no matter what you have out there, unless you have like a body or you have something like that, then people will always, you know, look at the other side. Someone also wrote in the forum, right, have you ever heard of a friendly reptilian being?
Yeah, but going back to the evidence, a number of these people also have implants, evidence of implants. They go to the doctor, and the doctor's like, well, what's this foreign body in your sinus? Or one lady, she had a thing in her lung, a ring of metal.
A ring, so, wow.
But yeah, absolutely. The evidence is there. As far as reptilians, you know, I don't get a whole lot of reptilian encounters, really hardly any. Certainly, you know, in doing conventions and talking to other researchers and certainly reading, I'm very familiar with reptilians, and I have talked to people who've had some very friendly encounters.
Oh, really? Wow.
You hear more of the less friendly, but one lady I know, she shook hands with she was like a 10-foot-tall, very wide, muscular reptilian, which appeared in her home. Another lady I talked to, Pamela Stonebrook, I think is her name. But she had an amorous encounter, you know, a very intimate encounter with a reptilian, which she enjoyed. So, some people do have friendly encounters with reptilians, but that's kind of the exception. I think there's probably, you know, there's different groups of all of these guys. Some grays are described as being very emotionless, very kind of arrogant, unfeeling, to the point of almost being cruel. They're not intentionally being cruel, but they have no regard for people's feelings.
Yeah, you know, whereas, is something that it seems to be, you hear that a lot, actually. You know, you hear people describe that a lot, I should say, and, you know, almost mechanical or insect-like with no emotion.
Couple of cases like that in the book, for sure. But a number of people have had very friendly encounters with grays who are, you know, absolutely do understand that, you know, they're uncomfortable. Ultimately, I don't think they're here to hurt us. The first thing out of their mouth, particularly in the grays, is, you know, don't be afraid, we won't hurt you. And while that's demonstrably false in some cases, when they start sticking people with needles and messing them up, you know, with health-wise, that's not their intention to hurt people. There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence of sadism or anything like that. I don't think they're flying wherever they're coming from, you know, whether it's the future or other dimensions or other planets or our own planet, wherever they're coming from. I don't think they're traveling all this distance to scare people. That's not their agenda at all.
I think it's observation, if anything. And just right, in the chat room, someone posted, once you go reptilian, you never go back. I thought that was pretty good.
I couldn't tell you.
Put that out there.
I'll let you know.
Let me just ask you this. What is, in your opinion, the most convincing case that's in your book of someone that you interviewed?
Oh, God. That's a great question. I would have to think about that for a second. Probably the last chapter. It's a very extensive case. This guy wanted to remain anonymous. I can understand why. But he had sightings involving numerous witnesses on numerous occasions, had missing time with another witness, had a lot of medical symptoms. He had a lot of evidence to support his encounter. I found his case, very convincing. But all of them were convincing to me because, you know, they all have witnesses. That's something I always try to do is interview their wife or their spouse or their family or their friends or whoever definitely was with them during the encounter. But that last case, boy, oh boy. Yeah, I could talk an hour on just that case alone.
Well, why don't you fill in a little bit more about the details of that?
Yeah, all right. I was hoping you'd ask. It's an amazing case. This guy, initially, the first sign that he was having encounters was he kept having nosebleeds as a child that were very severe. Had to be rushed off to the hospital because it just got really bad and it wasn't stopped bleeding. Doctors couldn't find any diagnosis. They ended up giving him a kind of a vitamin cocktail and sent him home. What he didn't tell the doctor and didn't tell his parents, because he didn't think it was related and he didn't understand what was happening, was that people were coming into his room at night, little people. He couldn't see them, but he could certainly hear them. He had a very dark room in the back of the house next to kind of a forested area. He would hear them, sometimes actually hear them talking in these kind of squeaky little voices. So he kind of relates that to the nosebleeds now, because later in life, that eventually stopped. But when he was a young man, he became a medical assistant and would drive to work with a coworker and was driving with her when this ball of light approached them. And they didn't know what it was at first. Came very close up to them, and they were driving home from work. And when they got home, it was about 2 hours later than it should have been. They were very confused. He didn't quite understand what was happening. He later had dreams where he saw these gray-type ETs coming from the field towards his car. And that's how it started. The lady he was with did not react well. She ended up, going back into alcoholism, lost her job, and was just very, very upset about that night. But he was clearly the target because it kept on happening over and over again. Usually the same type of thing. This ball of light would appear, and he'd have missing time. Try to go meet his friends at a bar. Finally got there, and they're like, "Well, where have you been? It's now 2 o'clock. We're going home."
Wow.
And he didn't even remember seeing anything that time. One time he's driving along and he started to hear them in his head talking, we're coming for you. The time is soon.
Wow.
And one time he's driving along and his cell phone rings in this tone that it doesn't do. It just doesn't normally do that. And he looks at it and says, "No number." He hangs up. He picks it up, hears nothing, hangs up. It does it again. He answers it. He hears this weird clicking and kind of buzzing noise, and then a voice says, "The time is soon," a male voice. And he freaks out, and hangs up. He doesn't know that this has actually happened to a number of people who have received these types of phone calls, ostensibly from the aliens.
Wow.
I wrote a chapter in my previous book about that. And he fit the case there.
Wow, I've never heard of that. But I suppose, if that these things are indeed happening, almost anything is possible, really.
I know it sounds bizarre, doesn't it? But I'm telling you it's true. It happened to Betty Andreasen. It happened to Bud Hopkins' star client, Debbie Jordan, Debbie Tomey. It happened to a lot of people who get involved in this. John Keel talked about it. It happened to a famous physicist, Jack Sarfati. He kind of credits it with his whole interest in physics.
Really? Wow.
It's actually a whole tradition of this, I found out when I did a study of it. And it makes sense if you think about it, because UFOs have the ability to affect radios and TVs and car engines and all kinds of stuff like this, and they regularly do.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're tapping into our phones, and that happened to this guy. He ended up having an encounter where, which was fully conscious. He was having all these flashbacks of grays and tools coming down from the ceiling and being taken on board. One time he's at home and he can feel them coming, and they're talking in his head. And suddenly he says, it just got very strange. The room started to transform. Next thing he knew, he was on board this craft, surrounded by these ETs, and they're talking to him. And they said, well, you want to know why we picked you? You've been asking us. Here's why we picked you. You need to know this. Now, this is what they actually told him. And they took him to this room, and lo and behold, this is probably a familiar story to a number of people. He saw a hybrid baby. He's told it was his. He knew instantly it was his. And he immediately got very angry at the ETs. He cussed them out, said that they had no right to do this. But at the same time, he was very attracted to this hybrid because it was his son. And also kind of disgusted because it was, to a certain extent, monstrous looking. Mm. So he had all these conflicting feelings, but was really irate at the ETs for doing this to him. Doesn't know why they picked him. He's got Crohn's disease, high blood pressure, smokes like a chimney. Not really a great genetic specimen, he says.
How old is he?
I'd have to look that up. I believe he's in his, at the time of the experience, well, they went on his whole life. I believe he's around my age, a little bit younger, so 40s.
Now, how about... this question's been asked before. How about older people? It seems like they're kind of left alone for the most part. Do you have any of these accounts with anyone, say, over 60?
Yes, okay. I do.
Let's hear about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, this lady is not in the book, but I her interview is clearly. She contacted me and... was really upset because she was 67 years old and still being abducted. Had a hysterectomy, had a history of being genetically, having her genetic material removed, the hybrid babies, all of this. She's like, why are they still taking me? I'm 67. They're not leaving me alone.
Wow, 67.
So yeah, it does happen. I don't get a lot of it. I think at some point they do start to leave people alone. It's different in each case. One guy I know, Kevin Cannon, he had a counter aboard a Navy ship. It was his one and only encounter. In a lot of cases, people have a whole lifetime of encounters. Another lady, she had only one.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's hard to pin down.
Now, the one question I've asked people, just for someone's opinion is, why... do you think that there's multiple abductions of one person if it didn't have to do with reproduction or whatever? Why would they choose the same person over and over and over and over?
Right. Well, we don't know. I can only speculate. I think that part of it is they're following that genetic line. People's health to a certain extent is maintained. So I think they're very interested in their, I'll call it a specimen. I hate to use those terms, but I think that's what we're looking at. So they're following these people throughout their lives, not only that, generationally. So it's some sort of a project, I think, to them. And they follow it very closely. I think that they're continually getting genetic material. The physical examination is the most common thing I hear. And there's got to be a reason for it. Could be, a lot to do with implants. Perhaps they're retrieving implants and putting in new ones. I think there's some evidence to speak towards that. But, yeah, I don't know. Some people get it once. But most people, generally speaking, if you're having an abduction, it started around age 5, continues up through young adulthood. There's short breaks, but... like Kenneth, he said it's every year or every other year he would have this missing time and onboard experience.
Wow. Someone said in the message board, maybe they're studying the genome, you know.
Yeah, it's all about the gene. There's no doubt they're so interested in us. They're interested in everything humans. They're particularly interested in our bodies. I think they know more about our bodies than we do, as evidenced by the fact that I wrote a book called UFO Healings that covered 100 cases of healings as a result of a UFO encounter. Mm-hmm. And they've healed, everything from colds to cancer, diphtheria, and diabetes, and I'm not going to go on, angioma, arthritis. These guys know the human body really well. And in fact, a number of witnesses actually will just call their ETs the doctor or doctors. There's a very strong hospital theme that pervades onboard experience.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. I have heard of, you know, people saying that they've been cured of things, which another fascinating thing. Going back a minute ago, you started talking about the electrical interferences in, say, radios and cars and things like that. You don't seem to hear about it as much as you used to. And it's funny because now cars have more computer-related, instrumental things that could be interfered with. There were many, many cases, you know, back in the 70s and earlier. But they seem, there's so many questions in this whole field anyway. Just another question, really, out there.
Yeah, well, I think that when someone's car stalls when a UFO is hovering over it, it's not necessarily an accidental byproduct. There was a wave of sightings in New Mexico and Texas, Lubbock, Texas, and that whole wave of 1952 involved a bunch of car stalling cases, more than ever before. And this is when it kind of caused lots of concern at higher levels, because at this point we thought that car stalling cases were relatively rare, first of all, and just an accidental byproduct. This looked like they were intentionally stalling cars. And I think that's probably the case. If they want to stop your car, they're going to stop it. And if they don't, because a lot of people have UFOs following them down the highway, following in front of them landing, and their car doesn't stall.
Right. I know I'm bouncing around. I probably should write some things down because I think of things, getting back to the question I asked earlier about why do you suppose people are abducted, so many times. I was just thinking about the polar bears. You know, we go to up toward the North Pole or the Antarctica, and they every year they will actually dart these polar bears and weigh them, check them for health, and then they must wonder what the heck's going by, going on with them, and they also have missing time too.
Yeah, I wonder if the polar bear's intelligence, compared to a human, is commensurate with the human's intelligence to an alien.
I would guess. You know what I mean? The answer would be yes on that one, or maybe even we're down a few steps lower than the polar bear comparatively, I think. Here's a great question in the forum. And have you ever heard of a case where the craft appeared larger on the inside than it did on the outside?
I love this question because I did a study of this. This was a chapter in my book, Not From Here. It was, volume one or two, I forget. It's called The Incredible Shrinking Abductee. Oh. Because there's a number of cases. This happened to Betty Andreasen. This happened to the Twiggs family in Oregon, and a number of other people who were actually shrunk down in size before being put into
a
UFO.
Themselves.
Yes. And I know how that sounds, but when these cases start to add up, there's the case of Carl Higdon in Wyoming. He saw this UFO was about 10 by 20 feet, box-shaped, not big at all, goes inside. It's absolutely huge. One guy in the book, the first chapter, we've got to get to his case at some point, it's my favorite case in the book. He noticed the room that he was in kept changing size. One point it would be small, then it would be large, and then it would be small again.
Whoa.
Another guy I talked to Same thing. He had a really good relationship with the ETs. Was not afraid at some point, was conversing with them pretty regularly each time he was taken, and notes the room changing size and asked them about it. And said, how big is this UFO? And they laughed, and they said, these were grays, by the way. They laughed and said, it's as big as we want it to be. Huh. And to close this, you know, idea down of that UFOs are bigger on the inside than the outside. There are a number of cases like that. But there's a case, oh, so amazing, from Leonard Stringfield. Leonard Stringfield is a very well-respected UFO investigator, best known for the UFO crash retrievals.
Oh, yes.
He was kind of the first guy.
He's no longer with us, right?
First guy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, unfortunately. But he pioneered it and received death threats and had a lot of trouble because of it. Mm. But bravely went forward and did hundreds of these types of accounts. Interviewed one guy from California, I believe it was, Camp Pendleton in California. Not sure about that, but there was this Army guy who was, had his secrecy level bumped up to, I think, top secret, was told to go photograph this stuff. He was an expert in photographing metal and this type of thing. And they take him to a UFO. It's about 20 feet across. And he's told to photograph the outside. He photographs the outside, and there's a door. And they said, okay, now we want you to photograph the inside. He goes inside and could not believe it. It is the size of a gymnasium inside. He looks back instantly outside, just double check. It's completely larger on the inside, which shows that these guys, these ETs, have not only incredible technology, but extends to the level of time and space.
Yeah.
If they can control space, they can control time.
Yes. Yes, I've had different researchers going back, some that are very seasoned researchers that think there's something like that happening.
I have no doubt. I've got two cases in the book involving time travel. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, that's kind of a fascinating topic to begin with. Why don't you talk about them? Or talk about one of them.
Yeah, all right. Well, I'd love to talk about the first case. It involves a gentleman by the name of Kevin Kamen. I think almost half the people allowed me to use their real names in the book.
That's always good.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, yeah, definitely. It shows that, I think it adds credibility to their account, and they're willing to stand behind their story publicly. And Kevin Kamen certainly is at the top of the list here. He's spoken publicly about his encounters, and is very vocal about them. He's a Navy medic. He's now retired. Back in 1980s, he was on a Navy ship. His friend and bunkmate was a personnel clerk, and his friend comes up to him one day and says, the subject of UFOs came up. His friend said, I've been in contact with aliens since I was a kid. They've came to my farm there. They abducted me constantly. They've taken me on board their ship. They've taken me to their planet, to other planets, and all this stuff he's saying. And Kevin's like, whoa, 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 hold on. He's always believed in UFOs. He did a school paper on them as a kid. But this is a different story. His friend was saying, he was in contact with ETs regularly. So his friend comes back a couple of days later and says, oh, I went to your house, Kevin. And Kevin's like, what are you talking about? They've been on a ship in the middle of the ocean. His friend starts to describe Kevin's house in detail, down to, the color of the carpet and the make of the car and, chocolate milk stain on the back seat. Just incredible detail. Hmm. But what was really upsetting to Kevin is these details, while accurate, were from 10 years in the past. Hmm. And we're not even there anymore. The car was sold that he was talking about. So this really upset Kevin because he couldn't understand it. He's thinking this guy's a CIA agent or he time traveled with his alien friends. So he says to his friend, if you're really in contact with aliens, I want to meet your little green friends. That's exactly what he said. And his friend says, okay, I'll see what I can do. Comes back a few days later and says, okay, they're going to come tomorrow. Are you ready? And Kevin's like, yeah, sure, whatever. The next day, his friend knocks on their cabin. Kevin's in there eating lunch, finishing lunch. And his friend says, "They're there. They're here. You know, they're up on deck. Go on up on deck and you'll see them." Kevin's like, "Oh, all right." So he goes up on deck. Can't believe his eyes. There's this enormous diamond-shaped object with colored lights all around it, much, much larger than the Navy ship, which, you know, is like 500, 600 feet. Right alongside the ship there, couldn't tell how large it was, but it was massive. And he's absolutely entranced. Does the first thing what anyone should do when they see a UFO is get another witness. So there was, of course, other people on the deck. He runs up to them, the mess cook. He recognized him and starts shaking his shoulder, but oddly cannot get his attention. It's as if he's not even there. And he's confused about this when suddenly, you know, Kevin finds himself not on the Navy ship anymore. He's on the UFO. He's looking down at the Navy ship, which is, you know, rapidly receding into the distance. And he realizes, oh, my God, I'm on board this damn UFO. And it's taken me away. He's like, "I'm AWOL." And the ETs immediately spoke in his head and said, "No, you're not. They don't even know you're gone." And he was too terrified to turn around. You can see the ground. It's, you know, kind of a metallic grate. You can see a staircase. You can see a panel with lights on it and little oven dials kind of thing. But he's not willing to turn around. He is terrified. He pinches his hand, thinking, you know, this can't be real, makes himself bleed, and it's real. And suddenly this UFO darts over to his hometown in Illinois and is looking over the schoolhouse where his mom teaches. And now, mind you, it's daytime where he was, and it's daytime here in Illinois. So something is going on here because it can't be daytime in both places. He's thinking, gosh, you know, I've got to be time traveling here. And he sees his mom teaching and can see what she's writing on the school board. He's trying to make sense of this when the UFO darts a couple of miles away over the building where his father works. And again, he can see through the side of the UFO. He sees through the building. He can see the air conditioner ductwork, the electrical ductwork, the construction material, right to the center of the building, really, where his father was a bank executive. And the ETs start talking to him again. They're like, "Your parents were nice people. They were very good people. They did a great job. They were very honorable people." And he's thinking, you know, what are you talking about? Why are you talking about my parents? Why am I here? Next thing he knows, the UFO darts again, and he's hovering, this time definitely way in the past. He can see himself. He's like 8 years old. There's his aunt. She's deceased. Very quickly, the UFO darts. There's another shift. He says he may have not remembered all of this. It was all very traumatic, very quick. But he sees these craters and this sand, and he's thinking, "My God, what is this? This is a bombing range. It's all gray." And he's thinking, "No, if I didn't know better, this looks like the moon." And next thing he knows, they come up over the horizon there, and there's the Earth, size of a tennis ball. He completely freaks out. He says he almost loosened his bowels. That's not the words he used, but you know what I mean. This is when he finally started talking to these guys, you know, in earnest. He's like, "Who are you? You know, why did you take me? Where did you come from?" This type of thing. First he says, "You know, why did you take me?" And they said, "Well, you asked for this. Isn't this what you wanted?" But he's feeling like a trapped animal. He just wants to get home at this point. He says, "Well, who are you?" Suddenly the room expands in size, and there's a star chart, a 3D star chart. He can see our solar system, all these stars, and way, way off in the distance on the far side of the room, which, you know, is now like 1,500 feet large, is this tiny little red light that's blinking on and off. And they said, "That's us. That's where we come from." Mm-hmm. And they proceeded to have a long conversation. They told him all kinds of stuff. They told him that they have been watching our planet for a very, very long time, thousands of years, but started paying very close attention when we started exploding atomic bombs, and that this drew the attention of all kinds of ET races. There are many ET races visiting us, they said. They said they are trading technology with all the major Earth governments. They said that they are they can speak all different languages. They are here to observe only. They do not interfere for the most part. They've told him they will not discuss politics, race, or religion.
They are smart. About that.
Right. Which is interesting if you think about it, because I mean, these are the subjects that are really kind of paralyzing us in a lot of ways, our progress.
Well, that's it for the free part of our show. Thanks so much for listening. Next week's going to be a great show. We have Marcia Barnett on, a very intelligent researcher of UFOs. You're really going to like her. So thanks so much for listening to the show. Remember, if you'd like to support us for only $2 or more per month, all you have to do is go to podcastufo.com. All the information's there. Thanks so much, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.